Welcome to All Things Marine, Hawaii's thought-provoking show dedicated to marine science and ocean conservation. All Things Marine, brought to you by Kosi Island Earth and the University of Hawaii, Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. And now, here's your host, the marine science gal, Carly Weiner.
Aloha. I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal, on this day, Tuesday, April 19th. I'm excited to be talking with scientists who just got off research vessel Falkor and who are currently on the ship working to study a remote hydrothermal vent field in the La'au Basin, which resides in between Fiji and Tonga in Tongan waters. First, we will talk with Rachel Boshin, a postdoctoral research fellow at the University of Victoria, British Columbia. Welcome to the show, Rachel.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Oh, no problem. And welcome back to land. I believe you just must have gotten home from your expedition.
Yeah, I got back on the 4th of April, so yes, not very long at all.
How does it feel to be back on land?
A little bit strange initially when you've had the boat and the sea rocking beneath your legs. You get a little bit land sick, but no, it's good to be home.
Excellent. And was this your first research cruise or first time at the site that you were studying?
It was my third cruise, but it was the first time at the site. So it was very exciting to see the La'au Basin fauna for the first time.
Excellent. And you guys captured some amazing video footage watching the ROV live streams of these smoke plumes and exotic life. Can you describe to us a little bit about what you were seeing in real time when you were out on the ship and set the scene for some of those of us that haven't seen any of this video or seen a hydrothermal vent before?
Well, it's incredibly exciting. So you've got this dark seafloor. There's no light down there. And you're trundling along with your robot with the light shining on the bottom. And then suddenly, out of the sort of blackness in front of you, there'll be this change in rock formation. You'll get the beginning of these gorgeous spires, which are the black smoking chimneys. And then as you get closer, you can see the actual smoke forming. And even closer, you can see all the little animals living on it in the shimmering water. It really is like stumbling across an oasis in a desert. They're stunning, truly stunning to see in real time. And they're always a surprise when we see them because we're never exactly sure where they are.
And was there anything that caught you by surprise when you were watching the video?
I was surprised by the abundance of life. So I've seen footage of these vents or similar vents from other cruises and the sheer number of animals. I mean, one net scoop of the snails, and we had almost 100 snails. And it was a very, very small impact on the chimney. So yeah, I think the sheer abundance of life down there was surprising.
Excellent. And, you know, I know there was a lot of scientists on board and everyone had sort of a different position. What was the overall purpose of this cruise besides to capture some of the imagery of this hydrothermal vent?
The overall purpose was to create sort of a 3D model of the entire vent field, which has never been done before. And the cruise leader, Tom Kosnichka, and his team had some amazing equipment to do this. And the aim is to create a sort of a 3D model that you could walk through in the right sort of auditorium type venue, so you could actually be on a level footing with the vents and see them as towering spires above your head, a little bit like city blocks.
And they were using virtual reality tools as well to see some of the imagery, is that correct?
Yes, they were. So we had sort of 3D goggles on board that we could see in real time the aspect of the vent. So I was able to stand at 2 a.m. With these goggles on and move my head around, and it was as if I was on the seafloor standing right next to the spire with all the shimmering water and the smoke and the snails, and you could turn your head and see it from different angles. It was stunning.
It sounds magnificent and, you know, something that you wouldn't often get an opportunity to do. So what was your role on the cruise? Were you helping with this virtual reality visualization or what were you doing?
I was the biologist. So I was sort of making notes on what we saw when we were doing the video transects across the site, which helped with the virtual reality. But my main role was to collect and catalogue animals that live there. So we've got an idea of the hotspots of biodiversity. And then we can annotate the model that they create from the videos to say, well, here we've got shrimp, here we have snails. And we can then go in and do detailed biological studies, A, through the virtual reality, but also through the physical samples we collected as well.
And were there particular organisms you were looking for, or was it whatever was down there, you were interested in it?
I was interested in everything because that's just who I am. But we did have specific organisms we were interested in. And that there's the possibility of deep sea mining in the area. And one of the things we want to do is make sure that if an area is mined, that suitable areas are protected. And to do that, you need to know, A, what lives in all these areas, and B, how connected the different populations are, which we can start to do through genetics. So one of the main sort of collecting goals for me was to collect lots of snails and shrimp, so that genetic studies can be done at this site and other sites, so we can help elucidate patterns in connectivity and also hopefully choose more suitable protected areas from disturbance.
Absolutely. That is so important. And the snails and other organisms that you were collecting, how did they differ from other snails that, you know, someone else would find normally in shallower waters or even on land?
So these snails were big. They were surprisingly big. I mean, you would struggle to get one in a coffee cup. I wasn't expecting them to be quite so large. And these snails only live here. So you get similar snails at different hydrothermal vents, and within the Lowell Basin, these snails occur in other places. But they don't live on grass like snails on land would. They're not reliant on photosynthesis.
Sure.
These guys live in complete darkness. They live through chemosynthesis instead. So they have symbionts, these bacterial helpers that convert the chemical energy from the vents into things they can use. So they live in complete darkness at high pressure. Some of them can survive 40 to 50 degrees C temperature. So they're pretty extreme little critters. And it's also very acidic down there. And obviously acid can dissolve shells. So a lot of these snails actually have holes in their shells or bits missing where they've got a little bit too close to the hot acidic water.
Wow. So they're hardy little critters. And did they look different physically besides the holes in the shell? I mean, what kind of colors were they?
They were quite cool, actually. So there were two different broad types. One of them had a smooth shell, quite large, quite thick, obviously to protect them from the hot fluids, sort of a browny black color. And it's different depending on where they live because they get mineral deposits on the outside of their shells. If they're close to an iron type area, then they'll get iron oxide brown forming on their shell. And there was another type of snail that was, it looked to be furry or spiky. It was very, very cool. It had lots and lots of little furry spikes on that didn't hurt you to touch. They're actually quite soft. And they were generally a white color. So yeah, I've never seen a spiky snail before. So that was very different to anything you would get on land.
Neither have I. I'm going to have to go back through the videos now and look for those spiky snails. So in looking at the snails and the other organisms, what methods did you use to study them? I know you mentioned genetics, but so would you collect one or two and then use the genetics from those species to make broader population assessments? Or how exactly did you conduct your research?
So, yes, a lot of it is done on collection. So I use two different methods. I will just study the video footage so I can identify what the animals are from seeing them from the video if we can get close enough and get high enough definition. But I also need actual specimens to go away and check that the identity of the animals I've got is right. And so they're sort of almost like types in that then I can say, right, this blob on the video was definitely that species, and I have a physical representation of that, so I can then go and check the morphology of it and what it does. And for genetics, yes, you do need individuals to take sort of tissue subsamples as well.
Excellent. And, you know, just so people get a proper idea of how the research is conducted, it's not a diver going in the water and collecting video of these hydrothermal vents. How are you getting these videos?
I wish I could go there in person. I really do. I am a scuba diver, but recreational limits for that are sort of 30 to 40 meters. We're talking about over 1,000 meters. So the deepest depth of this site was probably 1,200 meters maximum. So for that, you need either a submersible where a few people can go down there in sort of a submarine, or you need a deep sea robot. In this case, we were using a deep sea robot. It's incredible. It's bigger than a car, and it's attached by a long tether, a long cable to the ship, and it can go down to the bottom, and the pilots can control it in real time. There are a whole bunch of screens in the control room so they can see where they're going and what they're doing, and we can sit in there as scientists and say, please collect this snail or this part of a chimney. And it's great because it means you can get, you know, 20 or more people at the screen and dealing with the deep sea at the same time and coordinating sampling. Whereas if you've got a submarine, you've only got maybe three people that could make a decision.
Absolutely. And did you do anything special to the ROV or the deep sea robot? I know Tom Kwasniczka, the chief scientist, was working to get some of the video cameras specialized for the ROV so that he could get those 3D images.
Tom had an amazing amount of cameras on there. They had to do a fair bit of reconfiguring to the robot to get all of the camera equipment on. I think there are some good pictures of it on the website, actually. But there are at least, I think in total, there were at least six different cameras on there, some for Tom's work and some for the steering of the ROV. So he had different types of cameras. He had a stills camera that was taking a photo sort of every second or so, and that would be used to make the mosaic of the for the 3D model. He also had a fisheye lens, which was amazing because you can fit, obviously it distorts the image slightly, but you can then get the whole of the vent in one frame. And there were some really fantastic images that he made from that. The great videos, I think, are up on YouTube, actually. So if you have an Android phone, you can look at the image and actually move your phone around left, right, up and down. It's as if you're looking up and left and right actually on the vent itself, which is very cool.
It is. It is pretty amazing. I had some fun with those videos on the YouTube page. And the why hydrothermal vent communities? I mean, they're so far away. They're hard to get to. They're sort of out of sight, out of mind. What about them is of interest?
I think it's because they're just so incredibly unique. There's nothing else like them anywhere at all. You know, these communities, they only occur in those places. They're entirely reliant on those vent fluids. And they're very different to what we have anywhere else because they're completely independent of sunlight. I mean, practically everything else on our planet relies on sunlight. And one of the main reasons that people are interested in them is we think that's where life on Earth started. We think that the hot springs at the bottom of our deep sea is where all of life originates from. And that's fascinating. I think that's a very good reason to be studying them.
Absolutely. And so can you illuminate a little bit how the hydrothermal vents form?
So the geological processes behind them, you have these sort of meetings between your oceanic plates, and these occur all across the ocean. And what happens is you get little cracks in the seafloor and cold water, sort of 2 to 5 degrees, percolates through, and parts of the crust are heated by magma. So that water gets heated up, and then it becomes buoyant and goes back up through different cracks. And as it goes, it's very hot. It becomes acidic. It dissolves the various minerals in the rock. And when it reaches the colder seafloor again, obviously it's like if you've got a cup of coffee with some sugar in it that gets cold, the minerals precipitate out. And as they do, they can form the beautiful chimney structures that we see in the video. And that black smoke isn't actually smoke. It's very hot water that's got dissolved minerals in it.
So what kind of temperatures are we looking at of the water that's coming out of these smokers or hydrothermal vents?
Well, it depends on how deep you are and where you are in the world ocean. But one of the vents that we were looking at and spent a fair bit of time imaging actually on this trip, it was 325 degrees. So obviously on land, that would mean that your kettle's gone a little bit crazy and you've got sort of super steam going on. But because of the depths and pressures involved, it doesn't generally turn to steam. It's just very, very hot water.
Wow. And what depth was that vent at?
That was, I think, just under 1,100 meters.
Wow. So we're not talking shallow waters here. We're talking some deep water.
We are talking some deep water. Although having said that, the deepest vents in the world occur at over 3,000 meters. So in terms of hydrothermal vent type areas, this definitely isn't the deepest, but it's not somewhere you'd be swimming to anytime soon.
Interesting. And how, what are other ways that this vent site that you were looking at differs from some of the other vent sites that maybe you've researched in the past or other vent sites nearby?
What is very different from places I've been working at before. So I did my PhD working on vents in New Zealand, and one of the main sites I'm working on at the moment is somewhere in Canada. And although vent communities all depend on the dissolved minerals to support the bacterial life, etc., that then the whole community is based on, the different biological communities are different according to where they occur. So you have these biogeographic provinces, if you will, much like you have on land. So the communities we have in Laos are very dominated by the snails. There are lots of snails. There are also shrimp. Some areas away from the chimneys also have dense mussel beds. But when you compare to the New Zealand vent communities, for example, they're dominated by salt barnacles. Again, you get a few shrimp, and you get the mussel beds a little bit further away. And those two are different biogeographical provinces, but Fiji and New Zealand aren't that far away. If you then compare it to other sites, like in Canada, for example, where you'll get more tube worms or you might get clams, so different areas have slightly different vent organisms, and that's to do with evolution and the fact that these areas have been separated for millions of years.
Wow. So now that you're back home, you came, you saw, you collected your samples. What's the next step for you, and what's the biggest take-home message so far that you've been able to obtain from this cruise?
Well, the next step for me is to work on those samples. So I've got to do some more detailed identification of them and make sure they're curated properly. And then I'll be studying them to figure out what their ecological traits are and looking at the video footage as well, and getting help from some students to figure out where the different communities live so we can start filling in that beautiful map that Tom's creating. I think the take-home message from this cruise is that these are truly amazing communities. I think they're stunning, and being able to see them in real time, not just for the scientists on the ship, but for all the other people out there that were watching online, I think is truly fantastic. And mining may well happen in the future, but I think what's important about the work we're doing now is it's informing those decisions relating to mining. So once we've got a better idea of where things live and how the different communities are collected, if people mine, we can then select suitable areas to be protected so that the biodiversity of these sites isn't adversely affected.
Well said. And thank you so much, Rachel. I know you must be exhausted coming back from a successful two-week cruise. We really appreciate you making some time to talk to us today and look forward to hearing more about your work and findings at a later date.
You're very welcome. It's great to talk to you.
Thanks so much. Stay with us. We'll take a quick break, and when we return, we're going to be learning more about hydrothermal vents.
Chris,
welcome.
Put the video game controller down for a second.
I can talk and play. Oh, I'm totally annihilating this punk kid in Nebraska.
I just feel like you're not acting like a grown-up in our relationship.
M2.
Well, you know, you still ride your skateboard to work. There's the comic book collection, the race car bed.
Look, I'm young at heart, but I put money into my 401k every paycheck. I picked up a few savings tips at feedthepig.org. I have control over my financial life now, and that feels pretty grown up.
Put away a few bucks, feel like $1 million. Putting some money from every paycheck into a savings account or contributing to your 401k can make a big difference later. For free ideas and easy tips on ways to save, go to feedthepig.org. That's
feedthepig.org. So, I bet I look like a grown up to you now.
Well, except for the footy pajamas, I'd have to agree.
This message brought to you by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants, the Hawaii Society of CPAs, and the Ad Council.
So we had this break-in on our block, and that triggered my mama bear instincts. I work full-time, so I'm not home when my kids get home. Sometimes I'm not even home before dinner. So it got me thinking, what if that was my home? I had to take action to protect my family. We started researching home security systems, and the clear winner was Vivint. Best price, best technology, super easy to use. It's a fully monitored security system, but I love their video technology most. I can actually see what's going on in my home right from my smartphone, tablet, or computer. I check it before my kids get home, then again around 4, so I know they got home safely. I can even lock the doors remotely if they forget. Vivint keeps me in control of my family's safety, even when I can't be home.
Take control of your family's safety with Vivint. Order now for up to $1,300 in security equipment at no charge. Just pay as little as $99 for activation. Plus, call now and installation is free. Call 800-569-0364. 800-569-0364. 800-569-0364.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal. Today we are chatting with scientists from research vessel Falkor all the way in Fiji en route to hydrothermal vent fields on the La'au Basin. We'll next talk with chief scientist Dr. Chuck Fisher. Dr. Chuck Fisher is a deep sea biologist at Penn State University whose research takes him to vent habitats all over the world. Welcome to the show.
Why, thank you, Carly. It's nice to be here.
Now, I'm sure you are busy getting ready for this expedition, month-long cruise, and are very, very busy, so we appreciate you taking some time to talk to us today. Very interested to hear about the next cruise that's coming up and what you're going to be looking at.
Okay. Well, we're going back to a back arc basin spreading center between Tonga and Fiji, where we started working as part of a big U.S. National Science Foundation initiative back in about 2000. Now, my group in particular picked four different vent fields along a 100-mile stretch, and we set up long-term study sites on these in these vent fields in different animal communities in 2005. We returned there in 2006, and we were back there in 2009. And now we're going back a fourth time, and one of our overall goals is to see what natural changes there are in hydrothermal vent communities over time.
So what have you seen so far through the last couple cruises or visits that you've made?
Yeah, well, you know, there are a lot of different types of findings. We set up long-term study stations in areas of diffuse flow on the seafloor. And in one of those areas, we saw the flow starting to wane in the animal communities, starting to kind of regress, if you will, start to die out a little bit. But at some of the others, we saw complete changes in the animal communities where one type of animal was replaced by another one, just a kind of a natural successional process between 2005 and 2009.
And Chuck, Rachel just talked about deep sea mining or alluded to deep sea mining a little bit, didn't give much detail, but why is this long-term study important in terms of deep sea mining, and why would you want to see changes over time or monitor changes over time?
Well, so deep sea mining is coming to the region. You know, hydrothermal vents are known as polymetallic sulfide deposits to geologists, and there are ore quality deposits of gold, silver, and especially copper. So there's a lot of interest there. The economy's right, the technology's right. And these are communities that in some ways may be amenable to mining because they're communities that are used to change. They live on an active spreading centers, volcanic areas. They're used to having volcanoes, lava flows, big changes. However, we really don't understand the natural processes in these communities. There's other parts of the world where we've been studying hydrothermal vent sites for a long time, places that are closer to the continental United States, where U.S. and Canada ships and ROVs can work easily. These are much more remote communities, and we really don't have a good grip on how long they last or what natural changes are. And without that kind of information, how can we judge how fast they recover or if they recover appropriately after mining? So this the kinds of data that we're gathering will give us the baseline data we need to really plan any kind of post-mining monitoring efforts or restoration efforts that they may want to use.
Sounds like important work, and we're glad that you're able to do that. So your particular research interests within these vents is more the physiology of the animals. Can you tell us a little bit about what interests you about these species?
Sure. So it's interesting because I started out my career as very much an ecological physiologist. So the animals that live around hydrothermal vents are truly different than most other animals on the surface of the planet because they get their nutrition, in most cases, they get their energy from poisonous gases, hydrogen sulfide, which would poison you or me or most other animals on the planet if we were exposed to it. But these animals, the dominant ones in particular, in Lao, it's the snails and the mussels, as well as some barnacles and other animals, not only can use these chemicals, they have the bacteria that can turn the chemicals into food inside their tissues. So they not only tolerate exposure to these chemicals, but they can bring these chemicals into their body where the bacteria can use it to produce the food that fuels the communities. And in the Lao Basin, we not only have animals that are basically living off toxins like hydrogen sulfide, we have other ones that are using hydrogen gas as an energy source, and other ones that seem to be using methane as an energy source. So these are really fundamentally different ways of life that we find in these communities. And a major part of our research during this cruise, in addition to the ecology that I talked about, that is how the communities change over time, we'll be taking a detailed look at the physiology of these animals, bringing them up on board the ship. Pete Gerges, who will be out with us, has high-pressure aquaria he can do experiments in. So we're doing laboratory experiments and field experiments and time course experiments, all of which will give us a better understanding of how the communities change and why they change over time. It'll give us some predictive capabilities.
Wow. And they sound like amazing species to be so adaptive. I'm so fascinated to see what you guys do there. And you're going to be using an ROV. We mentioned this earlier in the show as well, to do the research. Why use an ROV, and what are some of the advantages of using the ROPOS vehicle that's currently on board of Falkor?
Well, sure. You know, when I started doing research at hydrothermal events, the only really reliable tools to do it with were submarines. I mean, these are animals that are living on average a mile deep, and the vents we'll be going to are about that depth. They're 2,000 meters or more. You can trawl from the surface, but, you know, all that, if you're lucky, you might collect an animal, but you don't know anything about it. If you really want to understand its ecology, see it in its natural environment, you have to have some way to have eyes and hands on the seafloor. And nowadays, the most efficient way to do that is to use remotely operated vehicles. So we'll be using one of the really great scientific remotely operated vehicles that are accessible to anyone, and that is the ROPOS, which is operated by a Canadian group. It has manipulators that will allow it, that are kind of like arms and hands, that are really quite finely tuned. They can do delicate operations on the seafloor. The whole time we're down there, we'll be recording everything in high-definition video from several different cameras, so we can really see what we're doing from several different angles. We can put special equipment on the seafloor. We can manipulate it. We can pick up animals and move them for some experiments. We can collect them gently and carefully into temperature insulated containers where we can bring them to the surface and study them. And I think, so all of this is necessary to study these communities. It's really necessary to study any deep sea community. But one of the great things about ROVs that we didn't have back in the era of using submarines is with a submarine, you've got one or at most two scientists that are in that submarine on the seafloor. So really all you have at your disposal is the knowledge of those two scientists to make decisions. Now you plan, and everybody on the ship, you know, looks at the pictures and makes good dive plans, but decisions are made by those two. With an ROV, you've got not only the whole ship full of scientists that can watch what's going on and give their input, but on this cruise, like many more cruises every year, we have a great ship-to-shore connection. So if we find an animal that, let's say, we have no idea what it is, none of the scientists on board the ship have seen it before, and this happens quite regularly when you work in the deep sea, our images will be all over the web, all over the internet. We can send a few emails out. People can, if they're not already watching and don't tell us immediately what's going on, we'll get responses within hours as to what we're seeing. And is it really something that's brand new to science, or is it just something that we haven't seen before? So I think that's one of the real powers of ROVs and of this expedition in particular.
Well, it also adds a level of excitement to the work that you're doing. Not only is it important in understanding these ecosystems, but the hope of discovery of something new is always, you know, something that will be at the forefront of everybody's mind. When you're down there with the ROV, do you get to see how the organisms interact with each other in these vent communities at all? Is there anything that you see that's really unique in the past working with ROVs?
Yeah. So, you know, different people have different research objectives. And mine for many years was to get the animals and bring them up and study them. But in more recent years, we've really, in my group, we've changed our focus into looking at how the animals interact with each other. So, in fact, we do spend time just watching the animals and recording their behaviors. But we also do manipulative experiments. We might ask a question, for example. One kind of snail is always found in this particular environment. Is it because it's the only place it can live, or is it because it fights with other animals to get there? So we can do an experiment. We can take that snail out of its little favorite spot, put another animal in there, and then watch them. Maybe watch them for an hour, go away, come back 6 hours later. See if, in fact, the other snail just leaves, or does it try to stay there and defend itself? Do they mix for a while? So we have learned a lot about an aspect of the vent ecology that we never really understood before, and that's the animal-animal interactions and what roles they play in structuring the communities.
Well, that sounds fascinating. I hope we get to watch some of that.
I'm sure you will, because we are doing some of those types of experiments.
Excellent. And now, Chuck, you've done a bunch of work on hydrothermal vents, but you've also done some work on some cold seeps. What are the difference between these two?
Well, so hydrothermal vents are animal communities that are basically found around undersea volcanoes. Largely, these communities are found around places where the plates that make up the surface of the planet are spreading apart, new seafloor is being formed, and there's hot water that's issuing up through cracks in the Earth's crust. And the water temperatures range from just a tiny bit above the seafloor ambient of 2 degrees to 400 degrees centigrade in some places. Now, and then that's the geology behind that. Cold seeps, on the other hand, occur in places where there are reduced chemicals kind of being slowly forced out of usually sedimented environments. So one of the areas that I work at a lot is in the Gulf of Mexico, and there's massive hydrocarbon deposits. There's all kinds of oil and gas buried under the sediments out in the Gulf, and sometimes it's just seeping out naturally. In fact, it's seeping out naturally hundreds of different places all over the Gulf of Mexico. Well, it turns out that those chemicals, when they come up through the sea floor, you get the same kinds of chemicals that the animals at the vents live on, methane and hydrogen sulfide, for example. And the animals are at the vents not because it's hot. They're there because of the chemistry. They're there because of the energy and the chemicals. So you have that those same kinds of chemicals, that same kind of energy, and you actually get the same kinds of animals. We have tube worms at cold seeps related to vent tube worms, mussels at cold seeps related to vent mussels. But the difference is, the really big difference is, cold seeps are much more passive environments. They last for hundreds of years. For your average vent environment, a particular spot on the seafloor may only last for years or decades. So the animals have adapted to that. Your average hydrothermal vent tube worm has a lifespan, a life expectancy of much less than 10 years, where your average seep tube worm has a life expectancy of centuries.
Wow. To be a seep tube worm then, I guess.
Yeah. Well, you know, as I have often said, the vent tube worms live hard and die young.
There you go. Life lessons from the species down in the deep. And how many hydrothermal vent sites are there in the world? Like, are these fairly rare environments, or are they pretty common?
So, let's see. I actually don't know exactly how many have been officially, you know, located right now. I'm sure it's in the hundreds. If you were to look at the bathymetry of the world's oceans, you'd see between all of the continents these lines, which are the mid-ocean ridges. And there will be vent sites all along all of those mid-ocean ridges. So I'm sure there are probably thousands of active vent sites with animals all over the world. But you've got to keep in mind that most of those are actually quite small. So many of the vent sites that I've visited, in fact, some of the ones we'll be visiting on this cruise, are kind of the size of a football field, or a soccer field. Some are bigger, but some are kind of that size. So there are a lot of them spread out all over the world's oceans, but they're very rare. If you were to just randomly drop into the world's ocean and expect to find a vent site, you know, it would take you thousands and thousands of random dips before you might come across even one.
Sure.
So they're both somewhat abundant, but very limited in extent, and overall pretty rare.
Yeah, and hard to get to. Unless you
and very hard to get to. And quite different. Different. Not all vent sites are alike. Different parts of the world have different types of vents. You know, just like you have different animals in Australia, South America, or Africa, you have different vent animals on the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, the East Pacific Rise, or the Western Pacific, where we're going now.
Yeah. And what do you hope to achieve from this research? So what is it going to take to make this a successful cruise for you?
Well, so I'm always primarily driven by advancing the state of knowledge. And we are going to learn more about how these animals live, what are their metabolic capabilities, and how do they interact with each other. On this cruise, I also, because of our long time series, it actually had, I think, 27 different spots on the seafloor where we have long-term study stations, we're going to learn more about natural change in these vent communities than anybody ever has learned before. So we're going to find out if, in fact, these communities in this area have lifespans that are measured in years, decades, or maybe perhaps many decades. We're going to have some real insights to that very basic question. We're going to learn a lot about what a new vent community looks like and what an old vent community looks like, so we can actually do a much better job of recognizing newly formed vents and only formed vents just by what the animals are there. But I think the bottom line is if we leave this cruise and we have significantly expanded what's known about the animals, their physiology, and their ecology, I would call this a successful cruise.
Excellent. Well, I hope that it is, and I wish you the best of luck in the upcoming month doing your research. We hope to be able to follow along with some video of the ROV, and can't wait to see what our vent snails do when you take them out of their home and put a different animal in there.
All right. Well, I'm looking forward to it, too, and thank you much.
Thanks so much, Chuck. We're going to take a quick break, and when we return, we will learn how the vents will be brought to us.
Marsha's identity thief wasn't a stranger. It was her best friend, her roommate. She put Marsha close to $100,000 in debt. Marsha ended up losing her home. A few years later, it almost happened again. But this time, she was armed with the proactive protection of LifeLock services. Shockingly, she again knew the thief trying to steal her identity. It was her son's friend attempting to get a loan in Marsha's name. With LifeLock's help, Marsha was able to stop the fraudulent loan before it could damage her finances and good name. Marsha found out the hard way that identity theft has become so complex, you simply can't find it alone. Your personal and financial information is everywhere. Don't make the mistake of thinking identity theft will never happen to you. Visit LifeLock.com now and enter promo code MEDVED or call and mention MEDVED for 10% off your LifeLock Ultimate membership. Call 1-800-921-3790. 1-800-921-3790. 1-800-921-3790. No one can prevent all identity theft.
Did you know that kids who drink before age 15 are five times more likely to have alcohol problems when they're adults? Alcohol affects their judgment and their future. So start talking before they start drinking. Learn more at stopalcoholabuse.gov.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal. Today, we're chatting with scientists from research vessel Falkor who are en route to a hydrothermal vent field in the Lao Basin. With us now is Dr. Peter Gerges, a professor in the Evolutionary Biology Department at Harvard University. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Peter. I'm so happy that you were able to call in all the way from Fiji. We just got off the phone with Dr. Fisher talking a little bit about what he's going to be doing on the expedition. How does your work differ?
Our work is different but complementary to the work that Dr. Fisher is doing. A lot of what Dr. Fisher is interested in understanding is the ecology of the organisms that live in this deep and remote environment. And that means thinking about understanding where they live and how they interact with one another. The research in my lab is really focused on understanding the physiology of those organisms and what allows them to live in this environment that's really different from ours. So in many ways, we study basically how these organisms work underwater. How do they breathe? How do they eat? How do they keep themselves alive? And so on.
Excellent. And tell me a little bit about the animal microbial symbiosis. You know, Dr. Fisher touched on that a little bit, but these vent systems are so unique and different. I'm curious to hear what you have to say about it.
For many years, we, as scientists and frankly just humankind, has tended to look at animals and microbes as though they were separate, meaning that animals did what they do and microbes do what they do. But we've known for a while now, and it's becoming much more prominent in our thinking about organisms on Earth, that animals and microbes live together. In recent years, a lot of people have heard about the human microbiome, right? The microbes that live in our stomach and help us digest our food and play a role in our own health. Well, in the deep sea, animals live with microbes as well. And in many cases, they have really specific, really closely coupled relationships with microbes. Some of the animals that do very well in these exotic hydrothermal vents have bacteria that they host deep inside them, inside their own cells even. And the animals have evolved to provide those organisms with the nutrients that they need, to provide those microbes with the nutrients that they need. And in turn, the microbes feed the animals. That's what we call a very tightly coupled symbiosis, and it's a very common way of living around hydrothermal vents.
And these interactions or symbioses, are the vent systems that they live in, are they stable or are they changing quite often?
You know, that's a great question, and it's really at the heart of this research program. A lot of times, for those of us who do work in the deep sea, we think it's a very stable place that's constant in temperature and not much changes. And that may be true in a lot of the deep sea, but it is absolutely not the case around these vents. In many ways, these vents are just like the hot springs that you see on land and the volcanoes that you see in Hawaii and on the mainland. They erupt, and they change when they erupt. And that affects where these animals live and how they make a living. And that really is the primary mission of our joint research expedition out here on the Falkor.
Well, there's so many things to study, so many interesting ideas we've been talking about today. What about the chemistry of these vent areas? Are you going to look at that at all?
Absolutely. A lot of my research really is trying to understand how does the chemistry of the environment change where these deep sea animals live. This is true for people as well. For example, an analogy might be trying to understand what do people who live in colder parts of the world, how have they adapted to those cold temperatures in a way that differs from, say, people who live in the tropics, like in Hawaii. At these hydrothermal vents, the environment changes in a similar way, but it's not just seasonal as it is for people, and it's not just a function of, you know, altitude, living in the mountains or living in the tropics. The chemistry changes because these volcanoes change. And when the chemistry changes, we have a sense that the animal communities change and the microbial communities change. And that's what we're really looking at. And to do that, we've designed a lot of really unique tools that can measure the changes in these chemicals underwater in real time from the robot sub.
Yeah, that's interesting. And Dr. Fisher mentioned that the species in these vent communities are fairly adaptable. They're used to, you know, different ecosystems or lots of chemical changes. But is there anything that we should be concerned about for these ecosystems? If you could advocate for one thing about these systems, what would it be?
One thing that humankind, including we scientists, often forget is that the deep sea, and I don't mean the surface waters, I actually mean the deep sea, mm-hmm. starting in a half mile below the sea surface, the deep sea in total represents 80% of the habitable biosphere of our Earth. So again, the deep sea represents 80% of all habitable space on Earth. Everything else you think of, deserts, tundras, tropical rainforests, even the upper half mile of ocean, all of that falls into the other 20%. So our planet is really dominated by deep sea environments. And the reason people should care is that the deep sea isn't just interesting in its own sake with its, you know, exotic animals that people have seen in movies like Finding Nemo, but it's interesting and important because the microbes and animals that live down there actually influence the health of our whole planet. And that's equally true for those microbes and animals that live at vents. So if there's one thing that I would advocate for is that we as humankind make a bit of a better effort to recognize that the whole planet is our home, including the deep sea, And in the same way that we will try and take care of our own homes, our own houses, we should really pay attention to these different parts of the world because, frankly, without them, our planet becomes less hospitable or even inhospitable.
And when you put it in that perspective, with that such a large area, it really makes you think about protection for the deep sea. Is there any protection or laws that prevent people from doing any damage to the deep sea?
Yeah, you know, scientists and policymakers have been working for a while to lay out laws and practices that protect the deep sea from obvious, obvious impacts.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, there have been laws on the books for a while now that prevent maritime vessels from simply dumping all of their trash in the ocean near land and the like. But we're also beginning to realize that there are ways that we have impacted the deep sea that we did not predict, and those are being contemplated now by policymakers and scientists and trying to better understand how we can make our ocean safer, not just for the creatures, but frankly for our own health.
Sure. And when working in these remote environments, you're gone for 30 days at a time. What happens if something goes wrong? How do you troubleshoot a piece of equipment or if you're trying to find something and just you can't find it? What do you do when you're so remote?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, working out on a research vessel is in many ways like sending spacecraft and people into space on the space station or on the space shuttle. Everything that we have access to is on this boat, and that is it. There's no hardware store. There's no, next day delivery. So over the years, we've learned to pack the spares and the extras that we need, but we also learn how to be quite improvisational and fix things using what equipment we have. There have been many times where I've turned to the galley, which is the kitchen, and asked them for things like tin cans or extra, yogurt containers because we needed more containers to store samples or we needed to build a widget to help us make collections on the seafloor. So it really is a little bit of fly-by-the-seat-of-your-pants science.
Sure.
But most of it is careful planning over many months to make sure we have what we need.
Oh, and I'm sure that has happened. But what a fun visual to think of someone opening up a yogurt can and having a deep-sea snail inside.
It has happened.
Oh, I bet. So tell us a little bit about the rest of the team. We've been able to talk to Dr. Fisher and yourself. Who else is out there with you, and what is everybody's role?
One of the neatest aspects of doing this kind of research is that if you're lucky, you get to come to sea with a team of people who have you do. Out here, we have scientists from Harvard University, from Columbia University, from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, from Pennsylvania State University, and even from the University of Vienna. And different members of these teams are contributing in different ways. So we have folks who are experts at making maps of the seafloor from the ship and from the submarines. We have other folks who are experts in policy and are thinking a lot about how do we manage these resources. We have ecologists and chemists, and, of course, the team that runs the remotely operated vehicle, or the ROV, which is the robot submarine we take to the seafloor, they're a part of our team as well. And they're the engineers who allow us to help us get this work done.
Excellent. And I believe you have one of those team members sitting with you today.
Absolutely. I have my colleague, Sharice, and I'll gladly pass the phone over to her.
That sounds great. Well, thank you so much for your time, Dr. Gurgis. I really appreciate it.
The pleasure is mine. Thank you. Enjoy.
So we're now talking with Sharice, who is a postdoctoral scholar at Pennsylvania State University, working with Dr. Chuck Fisher in his laboratory. She completed her PhD at the University of Victoria and recently finished a visiting fellowship at Fisheries and Oceans Canada. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Carly. Thanks for having me.
We're so excited to have you. And I know it's been a busy day. Not only are you working on the science, but you're also doing a lot of outreach on board. So tell us about these two hats you're going to be wearing.
Right. So first and foremost, I'm a scientist on board the ship. and I'm taking the lead on a research project that looks at animal communities at the hydrothermal vents. And then on my quote-unquote downtime, I'm the outreach coordinator on board the ship. So a lot of times when we're out on these expeditions, scientists get really busy and really into and focused on the work they're doing. And that's great, but they forget that we need to share with the world what's great about our work too. So I'm just here on board to remind people, you know, that photo that you just took of that new species or that finding that you just made, like the rest of the world would love to hear about it. And so I'm helping them get that out to our shore-based team that will help us delineate it to the rest of the world.
So I think you were being facetious about the downtime because it sounds like you are not going to get much of that at all. But I know you're interested not only in the outreach, but also in the spatial ecology of the hydrothermal vents. What exactly does that mean, and what does that translate to when you're looking at the video footage?
Right. So spatial ecology is the study of the distribution of animals. So what that means for my research in hydrothermal vents is that I'm looking at where the hydrothermal vent communities, so where those animals are living in respect to the environment, the hydrothermal vent environment that we find them in. So I look at the temperature, the chemistry, the geology of these vent sites, and then I look at the patterns of the animals, and I try to relate those two things together.
Excellent. And what about the difference in the animal distribution? Do you see the same in one vent versus other vent sites?
Right. It varies on every spatial scale you could possibly look at. If you move over a couple centimeters on a single vent, you'll go from superheated water that can be a couple to a few hundred degrees Celsius to the ambient water temperature at the bottom of the ocean, which is very much colder. And so you'll see an extreme difference just on that centimeter scale. If you go meters away, you're changing the environment from maybe a very dynamic chimney hydrothermal vent system to diffuse flow system. And you're going to see a big change in the animal community too. And then right next door to that, you'll just have your ambient sea creatures, so the ones that cover most of the deep sea that don't have hydrothermal vents at it. As soon as you start jumping across the world, you see completely different animals. For instance, we have very small tube worms at the vent systems that we're going to now. But then if you jump over to Juan de Fuca, another hydrothermal vent system just off the west coast of America, you see massive tube worms that are meters in size. And that size difference, that animal difference, changes the foundation of the communities we're looking at and affects everything up the food web.
Excellent. That sounds so interesting. I'm so excited to see some of the work that you're going to be doing on Falkor. Now, how, from connecting, you know, animals under the ocean to animals on land or people on land, how do you connect the community to the work that's being done while, you know, hundreds of miles or thousands of miles away?
Right. So a lot of work went into this before we even left port. We work with the Schmidt Ocean Institute, and we've set up websites, social media, YouTube channels. And so we have all of this in place, and we'll feed into that while we're out at sea. So we have a website where we'll be posting every second day. We'll have blogs coming out. We have a Twitter account with a hashtag ventlife_expedition. And then we have this YouTube channel through the Schmidt Ocean Institute that will be streaming our dives live in HD so that the world can share with us. And then we've set up special events. So if you follow us on the website, on the Schmidt Ocean Institute website, you can see what live events we have coming up. And during those live events, you can join in this global communication with the scientists, where in real time we'll be diving and we'll be taking and fielding questions, and we can interact with classrooms, we can interact with different institutions, and we can really share the experience with the rest of the world while it's going on.
Excellent. And if people want to learn more about the expedition, what's the website that they can go to find out that information?
Right. So if you go to the Schmidt Ocean Institute website and you click on the cruises of 2016, you'll see all the expeditions that the Falkor has been going on. And then there's a page for each expedition, and you'll see the active cruise that we're on right now, and then all the links to go to all the different things that I've mentioned so far are right there, just a click away.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for making some time for us. I hate to say that we're running out of time. I feel like I could talk about hydrothermal vent and deep sea snails and creatures for a long time, but I know this won't be the last we'll be hearing from all of you. There's a lot of outreach planned and a lot of exciting dives planned. So we wish you the best of luck and can't wait to hear more about the trip.
Thanks, Carly. Thanks for having us.
Thank you. I'd like to give a very special thank you to all of our guests today who made some time to connect with us live from Falkor, as well as those who just came off the expedition. I would also like to thank our sponsors, the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology and Kosi Island Earth. I'm Carly Weiner. Now get out there and enjoy our ocean planet.